Hello, and welcome to Non-Breaking Space. Non-Breaking Space is a show where we seek out the best and brightest people on the web and talk to them about how and why they do what they do. Your hosts are today are me, Christopher Schmidt, and Dave McFarland. We're two web designers, authors, and trainers who have a passion for sharing knowledge about the web. Usually, Chris Enns is here. He's a web designer and podcaster that we have asked him to help push the record button and keep everyone on track here on Non-Breaking Space. But he's not here today because he has a brand new healthy baby girl, and so we send our congratulations out to him. On our show today is Verlie Peters. She's a Belgian web and graphic designer known throughout the web world for elegantly designed web projects, tutorials promoting CSS, and her articles and blog posts on graphic design, web design, and modern home design. In 2000, she founded DOA. Is that right, DOA?
Yes, okay, that's right.
With Geert Lessee, is that right?
Geert Lessee. His name is even
more I was going to say Geert, but I really want to get his last name right. So it's Geert.
I find that always cute when people say Geert.
Yeah, it is. So how do you say again? Sorry.
Geert.
Geert.
The G and the R in the Dutch or in Flemish is rather hard for English speakers.
Yes.
so it's Geert?
We both have difficult names.
Okay.
Yeah, Geert.
Okay, Geert. Lassale? Is that it?
That's perfect, yeah.
Okay. Awesome. I'm going to hit record and paste that into whenever I try to say his name. They choose their projects based on how well they connect with the company. And I worked on everything from Expression Engine 2.0's GUI to innovative creative projects for the Library of Congress and sites for businesses large and small. So Dave, how's it going?
Hi, Christopher. Things are crazy, hectic. I've got so much stuff going on. I'm finishing up my CSS book, which is due in a matter of days. And
right.
Awesome. I got this big conference in December in Hawaii that you're putting on, and I'm presenting on jQuery, and I'm shooting this documentary in the month of November.
So you're doing a documentary now?
Yeah.
Dude, you're everywhere, man. Well, what's the documentary on?
I'm doing a documentary on this thing called National Novel Writing Month.
Oh, yeah.
Also called NaNoWriMo.
Yeah.
And my wife does it every year. This is her fourth year. Mm-hmm. So I am basically following her through the course of the month as she writes a 50,000 word novel.
Wow. And how many years has she been doing this?
So this will be her fourth.
Fourth year. Wow. So that's,
yeah.
So she's done at least three novels.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least attempted three novels, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. Wow. Nope. She's completed them each year. So.
Wow. That's awesome.
But it's always a struggle. Getting 50, that's 1,667 words every day.
Right.
So on top of, you're having a family and working
and
that stuff. So.
Yeah. I could give you 50,000 words. I just don't think there'd be any order whatsoever.
Yes. Well, certainly. Just go to Wikipedia, copy, paste. But no, she actually writes it from her own brain and all. So, yeah. So anyway, I'm filming it and I've been going to edit it, and I'm interviewing some other people and going to some of the events that happen around locally here in Portland. There are a bunch of NaNoWriMo inspired events, but anyhow, enough about me. We've got an excellent guest on today.
Yeah.
And
let's bring her on. Brill, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome.
Cool. Awesome. Well, we're really honored to have you here on the show today. I just want to know, how did you get started in, you didn't get started in web design right away, but you got started in graphic design?
Yes.
Right? So how'd you get started in design, and then, talk about how that, you got started with the design and how that kind of, you got morphed into doing web design too?
Drawing and painting has always been a hobby for me since I was a little kid. I think I drew more doodles and stuff when I was little than I watched TV, actually. And I always considered it as a hobby. But so in school, I studied totally different things. I didn't know what I would become when I was 16 years, even at 18. I just figured that I could do something with my talent. And not that I thought I had talent at that point, but I loved it. And so I heard from a friend that you could study like to become a designer in an ad agency, and like, oh, wow. Oh, that's maybe something I need to look into. And so I looked at two art schools, and I chose the one that was more geared to printing, to print design. And I thought, like, I felt like this is my thing. I want to learn, and I finally found something that I thought, like, this is going to be my profession. I was very convinced, but I was scared at the same time because I didn't have the skills. I was already 18, 19 or something, yeah, when I started. And most of the students, they all had like art school background. They came from an art school in before that, and in the higher school, I don't know how the name, how you name it in the US, but it's like, it's not university, but just one level down. The teachers, they don't teach you like how you need to draw and everything. You have an assignment, and they give you some advice, but most of the things you need to learn yourself. So I had to learn the drawing and the painting and everything. And I remember I gave myself a deadline because I felt like I was not, I felt like I was doing not as good as most of the students, but apparently the teachers saw that I had some potential. They saw evolution in my work. And so I had to work hard to get to a certain level. And then, I had my degree, I started to look for a job in print. And it took me a year, but I always heard the same thing, like my work was nice, but I didn't have any experience, and I was so eager to get started. And I think I jumped a little bit too fast into going freelance, because it was like, yeah, a matter of time. I was already negotiating for a job that And the owner of, there was a small print shop, and the owner said, like, yeah, I really want to work with you, but it was part of a bigger print company, and the big boss had to give his go. And so, and then after a while, I heard back, and they said, like, yeah, another person from the big print company was also aiming for that same job, and so he got the job instead of me. And I remember I said, like, if I don't have the job, I'm going to go for it, and I'm going to go freelance. Wow. So that made me like make the decision to go freelance. And it's funny, but here in Belgium, as soon as you start on your own, you had to go through tons of paperwork, like for the VAT number and such, and that takes like weeks. Because and so I started that, the whole process. And a few weeks later, that same guy called me again and said, like, are you still interested in the job? Because it's too late. So yeah, it was like, I didn't realize how tough it would be. It was a bit naive of me to go dancing all out of the blue and just, you know, with no experience, just the school.
Yeah. So you decide to go freelancing. Like, what's a VAT? Like, just in case people don't know who are listening, but what type of stuff did you have to go through? Like, what type of paperwork did you have to fill out just to start up freelancing?
I remember I had to go to the, but the terms are going to be hard to say in English.
Yeah.
It's really to start up, like a business here, you have to.
A lot of paperwork and bureaucracy that you have to go through. So VAT is, in Europe, you have, it's called value added tax, is that right? And you have to, all the work you do, you have to add a tax to it, is that?
Yes. So every work I do, I have to invoice, and the invoice has the VAT. So we're obligated to do it like that. And then all the costs that come. Mm-hmm. So invoices with VAT, and there you don't have a system like that. So there you can recuperate the VAT. Mm-hmm. So
wow. So you went from having not had any job experience in graphic design to running your own business.
Yes. in an ad agency, apprenticeship or... But that was actually not from the school. Some schools do that, like you have to do a month of apprenticeship and then just to learn. But I found an agency who was willing to give me like a 1 month to play around a bit. But it wasn't play around. It was actually a bad experience. I thought like it was just the beginning of desktop publishing. Mm-hmm. And I was... out that I had a bit of experience on the Mac already, and I thought like, okay, that agency has a few Macs, so I was already thinking like, oh, I'm going to be able to work on the Mac, but the boss didn't give me any chance. I just had to do some pre-sketching stuff like with markers and stuff, and then I remember the first day. It was really terrible. If you think about it now, the job that I did, I think it would probably take less than an hour. And I one day, there was this letterhead design, and at the bottom of the letterhead, there were all small logos, like from brands like Philips. It was, I don't know, it was with something with electricity stuff. I don't remember, but it was like all little logos. And I had to go downstairs to the darkroom and reduce all the logos. Yeah, it was really handwork on photo paper and put it the tiny logos on photo paper with special glue. And then I came to the boss with the other hat with all the little logos mounted on the paper, and he was looking with his magnifying glass to see if that logo needed to move a half a millimeter to left or the right. So it need to be, there were like, I don't know, 25 logos and two lines on a footer that I had to align perfectly with equally spacing. Imagine. It's like a crazy job if you think about it now.
So this was obviously well before the web came around. How did you get started in the web when it finally took off? I assume you were probably doing print stuff, and then you started to get an interest in the web?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was 1995 an internet connection and subscription with a very slow modem. I remember that my Mac usually had there was always like updates for drivers, print drivers, and I always heard the guy, yeah, I'll look on the internet, and I'm down, and I was thinking, yeah, the internet, that's something interesting. They always go look there. I should check it out. So I had the subscription for the internet, and then I. A bit later, there were pages with images, and then a bit later, the moving images and stuff. And I was like, these pages all need a design. You know, I was looking at it and saw that it was like growing a little bit into more layout and basic design. So I was kind of interested how it was created and I experimented with it. I remember I created a website for a local radio station here in our city. And I designed a site for them, and I was like in I don't know the app anymore, but it was like a bit like BB Edit. Mm-hmm. Oh, World Wide Web Weaver, it was called.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Uh-huh. With that, and from one thing came to another, so that's how it that's how it started. In 1996, I was actually creating websites. Wow. And I think my first client was actually from Taiwan. I was like, whoa.
Really? Like,
yeah, and the U.S. Also. Huh.
So, I think a lot of people who listen to our podcast are either are freelancers or hope to someday, you know, throw off the shackles of working for a corporation and want to follow your path and work for themselves. How did you, in those early days, how did you make it? I mean, how did you, A, find clients, B, you know, get food on the table?
Well, I have to admit that the first years were really, really hard. I totally underestimated it. And I think if I would knew it was so hard, I would make a decision. So if there's one thing I've learned, like from just jumping right through it, is to think about it first, like and indeed do a bit of investigation to see if you have... if you think you have enough work. I had some friends from friends who were promising, like, yeah, we have work for you and we have work for you. And I all believed it. And it was true for, so at some point it was true, but not like enough for me to live on. So first 5 years actually were really, really hard. The web wasn't there yet. And I was also not so good at selling myself. It was when I met Heert that he said, like, yeah, but you need to go on the road. You need to show your work. People don't know you. So why not take your portfolio and just, yeah, go? Or at first I did send, I had like a little brochure that I sent like as a mailing, and then I called companies, but that didn't really work very well. So I did the very direct method, and I just jumped in my car and went to companies and handed over my business card. And I remember like one day I did like 30 companies. I did it. And then... yeah, one called, and he was interested in doing a design for a brochure. And then I had the brochure as a portfolio thing to show to other companies. And one thing came to another, but it went very slowly and very hard. Now the time setting is totally different, and with the internet you can share your work online. It's totally not to compare, but on the other hand, there's so many of them, and you have to be, you know, you have to stand out. So it's also a big challenge for people starting out now. But I would say, like, make sure your work is online and that you are there in all the social media and stuff to make sure you're heard. So that would be my advice.
So what's your work like these days? Is it a combination of print and brand design as well as web design?
It's mostly web design and almost non-print, actually. Oh. Since I've done some print work, except the book cover designs, like for Aaron Gustafson's book and Smashing Magazine. But apart from that... a logo design is also something that's frequently do, and also iPhone and iPad app design, so mobile design that I do. Yeah, but mostly web, actually. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, how did you meet with? I'm going to mispronounce his name. Gert.
Goethe.
Yeah. So how did you meet him and start the company?
I met him actually when I started my freelancing. It was my sister and my brother-in-law. They had a pub here at the station, and I was a bit like concierge. I had my own. Not apartment, but I lived there, and I had my little office there at the first floor. And in the weekends, I was behind the bar working, serving beers and stuff. And he was a regular. And I always thought, like, if there's a place I will not meet my true love, it will be here. But I didn't. And so... and he was full-time working, but then he got, well, he was always interested in what I was doing, and all of a sudden he gave up his job and we decided to join me in my business. So he's kind of the person who helped me save my business, because it was just right before the internet came, and he was always like the guy who saw the potential in the internet and which direction we should go or I should go. He's good at that. He has like a clear vision on what would be the wise decision business-wise. So he has always like a very important factor for the reason why I'm now so far in with the business actually.
So you've been around since pretty much the beginning of building websites. I mean, 95, that's when I got started too. So a lot has changed. There's been a lot of evolution in not only techniques, but in style, visual style. How do you think, or what do you think of the evolution of design on the web from the early days to now?
It's been more exciting. There's more freedom in what we can do now than how it was. It was so restricted. Just think about type. Typography. Mm-hmm. The possibilities. And also now with the mobile apps. Well, that's of course not the web. And just pure from a design perspective, it's way more fun. It's also more challenging because we can do more. It more challenging, but creativity side, it's positive. So yeah.
What are some of the more recent innovations that really have gotten you excited in terms of techniques, or like CSS, for example? Sounds like typography, being able to use web fonts, that kind of thing. Are there other kinds of CSS tricks that are really exciting to you these days?
Well, yeah, the CSS animations that you can do, everything with CSS3 is pretty exciting, I think. Mm-hmm. It helps you to create more, you have more freedom, more possibilities. If you think now about a design, it's less in the... You think it less about, it's less in a static way. It makes me think almost like in the days of when we were using Flash, not exact the same. Uh-huh. So you start to think more about fun animated things. Click something, or the interactions mm-hmm. fun that you can do, or when a page loads, or you can do way more creative stuff, and the CSS is yeah.
So, have you actually been using CSS animations in professional work for clients?
Just limited, because I've been working with one big client for a couple of years and still am now, Fab. So I'm having my hands full with Fab these days, the website, the mobile app. So I've been really focusing on design lately and less on coding. There was a project that is now in the making, but unfortunately I had to outsource the coding due to bit of time. So unfortunately not. I've been like reading and gathering information, but it's hard to keep up if you're very focused on pure design tasks. So yeah, I'm trying to keep up with everything.
Okay. So how is the, you know, the project with Fab? Because as a freelancer, I mean, do you find it, you know, as a freelancer, you hop from job to job to job. And since you said you've been working with Fab for 2 years now, like how is that relationship? You know, do you still enjoy it? Do you still like, or do you feel like you want to work on other projects, or is it just a multitude of, you know, different stuff? You get to work on the mobile app, you get to work on the website.
Yeah, it's more like that. I had during the last couple of months, I've been designing the iPad app and version of the iPhone app, and I find it still very fun to do. I thought I would like get bored after a while, but it's like the iPad app was it's the first iPad app I designed. So for me, it was like a really nice challenge to do this design. And for the website, I think the site has evolved with new features, and it's constantly working on something new. Like when the site launched, there were just the sales pages, but then later that grew. The amount of sales became divided into categories, like for foodies, for pet lovers, etc. So it constantly grew, and it constantly needed new designs and new challenges. So, like for if you're in if you remember, I don't know if you remember the first when it was launched, there were no categories, but now you have all these categories and you can filter, sort, so they're all like factors and aspects that I had to think about and to make it still work nicely for the user and not like that they're like lost easily. Product they like, so the interface challenges were nice and are still nice to be to design for. So that's why I still like working for Fab, because it's constantly still a challenge, and I combine it with other projects, smaller ones on the site. Mm. So that's a nice variation to have.
So. What's your, like, you have a good perspective then, like, what lessons did you learn from, I guess, from having to go from print design to web design to designing a native mobile app? Like how was that, like, going from the past experiences that you've had? What lessons did you learn about designing for an iPhone and based off of your history of designing?
I think especially like for the mobile app design is that you try stuff out, make sure you look at enough apps to see what's possible and can do for the user to make it easier, because you have the small screen, especially for phone. It's always like a challenge, like with the movements with the finger, and to hide the menu and make it still reachable, stuff like that. The things I learned is, yeah, mostly that you have to try it out, and also when you design it, look at the screen and see if there's enough contrast, if the tapping area is big enough, stuff like that. Test, I guess.
So you do a lot of like iterations with mobile than you would with a website, you think? So what type of challenges did you, like, you know, you overcame? So you talked about the menu navigation. So what about the menu navigation was really tough? Was just trying to move it around, move it, just hide it, or like?
Yeah. The first version didn't have that kind of menu that we have in the last version. It's just an icon that you can tap, and then the menu reveals. Before that, it was more the traditional, I don't know, the Apple interface look with the buttons at the top and the bottom. Right. Because it takes a lot of the screen at the top and the bottom. We try to find ways to hide that a little bit more, so you can use the extra room. I think also that through the past year or years, I don't know, that people got more and more familiar with certain conventions, I think. Mm-hmm. Apps can work, like Facebook uses the same technique on their mobile app for their menu. You have the icon on the top left, and it reveals the menu. We do the same movement. So That's why I think you have to look around and use enough apps to see, to find ideas and learn from them.
So it sounds like in a way it's like a new frontier, like the web was in like the mid-90s, right? Like you just have to try new things and
see yeah.
it work. There's no like, I mean, I think we're getting to a point now where like we have design patterns for mobile that are just coming out, and they're not just coming out, but just we've kind of trying to find mobile's way of being. Like they're just the way of working with a mobile app, right? In terms of like a website. Like now we have breadcrumb navigation, we have logo placements in the upper left-hand corner. You know, there's certain, not cliches, but certain ways of web design that we have grown accustomed to. And so we're just like, so now you're saying we're still in that initial phase for mobile, right?
Yeah, in a way we are, but you see sometimes new things appearing. But yeah, there are certain patterns that people know, like how to refresh your feed. Like if you're in the app, the Fab app also has like a live feed where you can see what others have purchased or liked or pinned. And people just know that you have to like to refresh, that you have to slide with your finger vertically, like on Twitter. The Twitter works like that as well. It has the same refresh technique. So things like that are becoming common. And it's exciting to do like stuff that are a bit different. Like I remember with the before Fab was Fab, it was called Fabulous, and it was a social media website for gay people. So I did an iPhone app for that as well. And one of the things was like there was to find people just like random. There was a randomizer in there. It was like I drew like a jacket thing, and so people would just shake their iPhone, and then you saw that thing rotating like jackpot, and then you saw a member on the screen. So stuff like that is.
So I think a lot of designers are trying to work out the proper workflow for creating mobile apps and mobile websites. It sounds like you work with a team, so you're handing off designs to the developers. How do you hand off a designer? What do you create? What are your deliverables that you are giving to the production team?
I deliver actually all my files in Photoshop font, and they start from there. But I make sure that everything is like vector based, so it's all okay for the Retina display. So everything is scalable actually. Mm-hmm. So icons and except just the photos that are in there, then they are not scaled, but rest is everything is scalable. So it's Photoshop, but it's vector based.
And then how do you describe interactivity? I mean, you know, because now we have the drop down menus and things pop up, and how do you communicate that to the production team?
In Photoshop, I also do work with layer comps. So I present them in a design, like when you tap, this is how it looks when you tap on a button, stuff like that. So with layer comps, I can then export just screens as JPEGs and they see it like that. And we also discuss it together, like just verbally, mm-hmm. but also make sure they have everything in as a design, so they actually see and the rest is actually verbally, like with the jackpot, for instance. I can only deliver static images and then explain what I would like it to do. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Do you have do you guys have conventions for, like, for example, in Photoshop you name your layers in a certain way so they understand that one layer is the hover state, for example?
I do that by default, because otherwise it's not workable for me. I have the good habit to name everything. So, but from their end, they have never demanded or asked anything like we would prefer it like this or that. So I did once export everything, like the icons and the different states, using Slicy. I don't know if you know the app.
No, what's that?
The Slicy app now too. It's from it's actually from a Belgian company. Who is also the creator of CSS Edit and Espresso.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
Use it for, yeah, also for exporting web images for your websites. But I use it for the iPad app because there were like lots of icons, and there I name my layers exactly how the file name should be. Like I don't know, icon underscore. And yeah, and name, and then .png, and then I also make sure there's a special layer to export the icons for the Retina display. So it's pretty handy. It's otherwise they had to save like 100 icons in different states and different sizes, and so that helped a lot. That's workflow I presented to them, mm-hmm. And so now they're using it as
far
as.
Oh, that's great.
One question I have is that you know, fab.com has a very specific color palette of like black and red and white and maybe grays in there too. But you know, and since you are also known for having a really kind of almost trademark color colors in your designs, and yeah, and I wanted to ask about that, but also I just want to ask like What do you think about that? Because like, your website is very colorful, yet it's not too like crazy colors. Like, you know, like people can just go crazy with colors, but in terms of like a rainbow effect or whatever. But you seem to have like a nice, I don't know, kind of controlled chaos, I guess, if you will, in a polite way, I guess it was. But in terms of your color choices, and can you is talk about where that came from?
That's hard to explain.
Yeah.
I don't know, it was already clear in art school that the teacher said, you have, like, I remember my screen printer teacher, he said, like, you have a nice way of using colors, that's your strongest point. I always got that remark, I don't know how, yeah, I don't know, but like for Fab, I knew that the products would be like the most important thing. And I immediately knew that, and I felt also from the people, well, the two founders, because at that time it was just the two founders that I just worked with, and they were already thinking of not using all too much color, keep it very sober. So I thought, like, why not use just black and grays and use red for highlight color. So it was pretty clear from the start. But I find it actually very nice and a nice challenge to design something with only these colors. So it was like fun to do. And I don't know, I think it's like a feeling that I have. I can immediately feel or sense if something works together or not. It's hard to explain.
I can understand that. You just have like, you just know when you see it. So my other question is like, is against, you know, you were there at the web at the beginning, and at the beginning, you know, representing colors on the web was difficult, right? You know, because you didn't have a wide range of colors for to choose from, because that in terms of people's monitors weren't that great in terms of, you know, showing colors, mm-hmm. and stuff like that. So like, how do you feel about your colors now? Like, do you worry about the color choices and making sure they work the same on Mac or PC, or do you just, you know, like, what is your workflow in making sure your colors that you work in Photoshop appear in a web design or an iPhone app?
Well, I use color management, I mean color sync, mm-hmm. So in via the Adobe apps, so there I make sure I have like a correct setting and that my screen is calibrated. I use Color Monkey. I don't know if you know Color Monkey. It's a device that you can use on your screen. Mm-hmm. So coloring. It's actually now red. I should do another scan, another calibration. I do that like every 4 weeks. And I have like a setting for web colors. Mm-hmm. Use that for, but I assign my document with that specific color profile. And so when I export my images, I see no color shifting. Of course, the Mac PC thing and then the whole range of screens, that's another story. But I think, I don't think you need to aim for the bad screen. Mm-hmm. to have that like the standard and then, starting point. I think the more quality screens or the, because then you like, if you use that as the starting point, then people better quality.
Yeah.
And more for the other, if it's good on the medium range and it's less, it's because of that screen. That's my opinion then.
So when you get a new client, let's say you're kind of going from the ground up and doing like a branding project for a new company, the logo and everything, how do you go about thinking about a color palette? What informs your choices of which color you think our colors will work for a particular client?
I first try to find out what the client likes, what he thinks his colors should be for his logo and his brand. And sometimes they don't have an idea, mm-hmm. but they have. I show them examples, or I ask them to look up some to show me some examples that they like. But usually I present them with different choices. But some businesses ask for a particular color, and others are like, that you don't know. That you don't associate stuff with, like, for example, if it's a company that has something to do with ecology or nature, it's obvious you're going to go into the green and browns and natural colors. Colors from nature, but others, they don't. People don't associate any color with it, and then I try to just present nice combinations, actually, and then we go from there. Mm-hmm. I try to. Luckily, I never have clients that have bad choices, but in the early. Yeah, because now when years go by and people come to you, it's different. But in the early days, when you have to take what you can get, you sometimes have clients that have like bad taste, and then it's way harder to steer them away. Like, no, I wouldn't go for this. I would go for that, for this palette. But yeah, it's a matter of showing them enough options, and but not too many either, because that can work bad. As it can work like that you present two or three ideas, and that he likes or she likes something from idea one, something from idea two.
Right.
And you have to mash it together. There's always situations that you need to try to avoid. But
So, if I was to talk about just briefly about the tools that you use for color, like I have no idea what Color Monkey is. What is Color Monkey?
It's a device actually. You can that calibrates your screen.
Okay.
And it's very simple. It works with software, and it takes you through the steps. It's you put it on your screen and you start up the software, and then it's you need to turn a wheel. It's all like guided in this, like what you need to do. It shows an image of that device, like now turn this and then put it on your screen. And then it's like, it only takes a few minutes. It's like a step or three, and at your screen is calibrating. You see it flashing from red to green. So first it measures your light environment, your or environmental light. And then it starts to scanning, calibrating your screen.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's a device that you get. A company X-Rite makes it. They've been around for a really long time. They've made all sorts of color management calibration stuff. I use one by the same company. It's called I1 Display. And like Viral's saying, you just put it on your screen, and I do it every week. It reminds you. It pops up a little message, and it just goes through. And I don't know how it does. It's magic, but it knows what the colors are supposed to look like through its software, and it just tweaks your monitor, gives it a new color profile, and you use that color profile. And it's really awesome. It works with so if you're in a bright office, it works with the ambient light, so it helps kind of figure out from where you're sitting with all the light around you on your screen how that might affect the colors. And I do it a lot for photography, and it's really an amazing tool.
Right. So it's a tool for like calibrating the print with your own computer, the colors, is that right? Like the outside world with your computer, is that?
Well, I think it's more like the software has an idea of what colors are supposed to look like, and this device is on your screen, and it flashes through, the software flashes through colors, and it says this color should look like this. So it knows that it'll have to adjust whatever the settings are on your monitor to, you know, change the gamma or the brightness or whatever to match with the colors that it has programmed into its software.
Okay, cool. All right, awesome. But I'm just trying to say, it's like, so that will give you an idea of like fixing your machine for the colors with like your photos and your environment and with your computer. My concern is that, does this help you with like designing graphics for web delivery? Like, you know, in terms of like, do you encode a profile into your images and put them into a web page and stuff like that? Is there something different that you use, or something that you use in addition to ColorMonkey, or is it just, or you just use ColorMonkey for that? Is there any other part of the process for color syncing?
You're asking me?
Sure.
No, it's been a while since I set it up, but I don't think the profile I use is just a web profile. I'm just wondering if it's... It's not linked to the ColorMonkey, I think. ColorMonkey just looks at your screen to see if you're seeing, like how Dave said.
And then you said like the ColorSync utility for Mac. So you just, and that's just for like profiling or calibrating as well, or do you use that with the ColorMonkey, or how's that?
Say that again, sorry.
No, no problem. Yeah, no. So with you mentioned earlier like the ColorSync app.
Yeah.
So is that just for calibrating in addition with the ColorMonkey?
Yes.
Okay. And so, okay, awesome. So it sounds like, you know, like I remember in the early days of the web, it's like we had like the WebSafe palette, you know, WebSafe colors. And, you know, like, do you bother using the WebSafe palette anymore? Or?
Oh, actually, I used to in the early days. I did. Yeah, we had to. But now not, because, yeah, the monitors are all there now and can have so many colors. And now with Retina displays, even sharper and better. So
I think it goes back to like what you were saying earlier, that like things are just like, talking about your job, your first job where you had to go, you know, to the basement and do the photograph of the logos in the footer, you know, in this really slow process. And now it's sort of like with web now that, you know, we don't have to worry about color choices or like, you know, making sure our colors are web safe or anything like that. It's just amazing. But, you know, but we still need to do a little bit of calibration and stuff like that. So I'm really going to look into this ColorMonkey tool for helping out with that. So I think that's, but because I worry about making sure that we don't have to worry about kind of like limitations too much with our browsers, but we still have to worry about, you know, the tablet devices that are coming out, like in terms of like the Nexus 7, which from Google, which I love. However, it's not as bright as like the other tablets on the market, and so I worry about you know, the color reproduction of these images, that, you know, and especially with the colors that you pick and how they're bright and vibrant, and, you know, and how they show up on different devices. And so do you do anything in addition to ColorMonkey like that, or you're just you know, good to go?
The only thing I make sure is that the files have a certain profile attached. I use the sRGB profile. Okay. You know, and that's actually the profile that you use for web. So it's web safe. It's the profile that comes closest to showing the colors that are the same for everything on the web. So because it's complex. I found that's very complex material, because the browser themselves also have, some browsers have their own color management thing going, and when using this profile, it makes sure that your images or work look the same in all browsers. And if you're using CSS colors, the numbers, they are exact the same. If you would use the color picker, the Photoshop color picker on a certain color, it's exactly that color that you will get in your browser.
So is someone else there talking to?
Oh, sorry, it's probably here that you are.
Well, yeah, tell them we said hey. So, that's awesome. Cool. Well, we probably need to talk to him at one point too. So, but I think it's probably a good time to bring it to a wrap. But there's a question that we always ask is, what are you passionate about the web right now? I mean, you've seen pretty much everything with the web, from like, you know, from the early days of the web to now this mobile explosion that we have now. Like, but what part of the industry are you really excited about?
I think the mobile thing. I don't know. It's just the beginning, so who knows where it will go. it's also challenging, because it's so, we're still like in the early ages to find what is the right steps to proceed for just the technical part of it. You know, the HTML and CSS is becoming really complex. Mm-hmm. There's many methods and ways. So, but in general, I mean, what you can do with mobile and everything. So that's an exciting part. I don't know where it will end with all those apps and stuff you can do. Yeah.
Well, Daryl, thank you so much for coming on our show. How can people find out more about you or follow you on Twitter or any other kind of social media stuff?
People can follow me on Twitter via vpeters. That's my ad handle. And on my blog is veerle.duo.com. I'm also on Facebook as Peters. Dribble, also on Veerle Peters. And on my blog, on my About page, there you have also the social and stuff. So, yeah.
All right. Well, thanks so much. Yeah. And I do recommend to our audience to check out Viral's Dribbble stream, because she's prolific. She's got a lot of stuff on there, and it's beautiful work. We'd like to thank Chris from Canada. He's not here today, but thanks for being our producer, and congratulations on your new daughter, and I hope everything's going well. Thanks to the listeners, and if you would like to rate us on iTunes, that would be awesome. We appreciate it. And get the word out about our show on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks, Viral, for joining us on Non-Breaking Space. As always, you can check the show notes out at www.nonbreakingspace.com for all links and sites discussed here during the episode. And special thanks to our sponsor, which we don't have a sponsor.
Yeah, we don't have those, man. I don't know.
So anyway, we'll have to edit that out. But anyway, Viral, thanks so much for being on the show. It's great talking to you.
Thank you, too. It was a
thank you so much.